I didn't do well in the 5 words. In fact, it seemed to me that I hadn't used any of those words in any of my books. It's not, must be a sign of something. I thought I would, first of all, thank you very much for the chance to read in Cork. The last time I did anything in Cork, I was an external examiner in physics at UCC. And as I was going down to do this terribly important job, somebody said to me, you know, in Cork, they can't actually form a sentence that doesn't have the word Cork in it. I said, don't be ridiculous. I opened the first examination paper, and there it was. Question on nuclear physics involving an element called carconium. So, I'm not going to talk much about physics tonight, but the first poem. But the first poem has something, some physics connection. As I watched some of my best students, particularly in theoretical physics, take themselves into the murky territory of finance, and then we had the crash, of course. So I wondered how they would use their new language that they presumably have to absorb to form relationships, if indeed they would form any relationships. So this is called City Love. You look into your true love's eye to see what terms and conditions apply. Although your offer of love is rejected, your statutory rights are not affected. The sweetest love's in anticipating. The customer knows a call is waiting. Your call, more lovely than that of the linnet, is charged at 58 cents per minute. Counting the cost of true love's obsession, failure to meet payments can mean repossession. And finally, how many I love you departures before you learn past performance is no guarantee of future return. That could almost win the five words competition. So I've no more of that. I'm reading basically through the three collections. So that was from the first one. I'm staying with the first one, and come to, I suppose, first collections tend to be about the old adage about two commandments, write about what you know, and the second commandment is write about what you don't know. So the collection then turns out to be a kind of mixture of those two things. And what you know, as any poet hopefully knows, the nearest object of inspiration are your parents. Particularly if they're long gone, then you can sort of free reign. I'm going to read a poem, two poems around my mother. And the first of them basically picks up on her rather strange kind of two commandment system of her own, which was one. The first commandment was be very, very careful when you're playing down at on the road or on the river or near the train lines. And then the second commandment was, if you are playing near the road or by the river or near the train line, be sure to have clean underwear. Lament. Letting you down on the big occasion, between the ungainly shunting and the muffled thrumming of clay, I will place on the ritual shovel rosary beads, brown scapular, freshly quartered handkerchief, shoes blacked with elbow grease, white shirt, the collar starched stiff, short trousers pressed to a crease, and clean underwear, still waiting to be struck by that unseen car, making a holy show of us all, kneeling in front of everyone, naked of the day. And she shows up in this next poem, which is, I suppose, shows up in the sense that she's a very practical woman, and everything that it's used could be reused. And so, shortly after my father died, I came to spend a couple of nights with her, and shown up to my old room, and there in the bed was a hot water bottle, of course, and wrapped around the hot water bottle were the pajamas that my father died in. So it was going to be a pretty tricky night, basically. Dead men's clothes. But what could be more natural? Waste not, want not. It's an ill wind, etc. Then I'd wear my father's elegiac pair of paisley patterned silk pajamas, in which he breathed his last. By this, I try in vain to keep his self alive, myself asleep. How fitting then that I should wake and be convinced that I could make him out amid the gathered gloom of this too heavy curtained room. No Hamlet I, on with the light, and I am shaken by the sight of my own son. He looks so spry in my best suit and new black tie. And to give some, I suppose, extra ordinary to these early poems. I'm just remembering there was recently a situation caused by our current Minister for Culture and the Arts in McGilltown, Josefa Madigan. Apparently she turned up for Mass and the priest didn't turn up. Josefa, she took over and didn't quite do a whole Mass, but she did various readings and that, and got herself into a bit of trouble for that. But it reminded me of something that I had come across when I was preparing this book. And some of you may know about it already. It's the concept of the sin eater. It's this idea that if something doesn't turn up, then you basically make do. That's what humans are best at. And the sin eater operated around parts of Ireland, parts of Wales, where there was no priest available. And somehow or other, the community nominated, or whatever, somebody in the community to be this sin eater. And this guy, and it was always a guy, either took on the job or was given the job of turning up at a wake or a funeral and eating a symbolic meal over the top of the corpse, and thereby eating the sin of the person. So, you know, the idea was to, because you couldn't get their sins forgiven, a way of dealing with that situation. It's a somewhat chilling idea in many, many ways, because apparently the sin eater individual becomes as ugly as sin. And the other element of it is that when he dies, what happens? He's carrying all the sin. And it's his son. It's his son then who has to step in and eat sin of all the community through his father. Interesting. We didn't expect a sermon at this time. Anyway, I of course took the short road with this one and decided I would consider what would happen, or what would be the ideal meal for the sin eater. The sin eater. Here's a snack, to stave off hunger. The place laid out, all dandified. Mine host beneath the tabletop would have me eat until I'm bust. The small potatoes of his pride, the curd of his covetousness, the lady's fingers of his lust, the artichoke of his anger, the gizzard of his gluttony, the jellied eels of his envy, the suet of his sloth. And for my grace, I am to bless the one whose pittance calls the tune. Once more I sup with a long spoon. Next collection, which was called Safe House. This is the difficult second album syndrome. And not so terribly happy with the collection. But there were three themes in the collection. One was poems about the north, growing up in the north of Ireland. I'm going to spare you those. Go on to the second theme. And the second theme was sequences. I've always had difficulty writing longer than a page, and so the solution to that kind of problem, if it was a problem, was to basically create sequences of poems. And one of the sequences is, I suppose, links with the Sin Eater to some extent. It's a sequence based on the sacraments, the seven sacraments. And it's always interesting, not everybody agrees with the order of the sacraments. I've read this in a few places, and people say, that's not the third sacrament. So anyway, I'm going to read the first two. Everyone pretty much agrees on the first two. And first one is baptism. And so the way I've sort of treated baptism is to remember a boy who was I was at school with in Belfast. And he was very, very overweight and couldn't take part in the regular sort of sports. And people didn't tease him. Looking back, I thought that was pretty good for that time. Didn't tease him. But of course, if we had teased him, we would have had to recognize how wrong we were about him. And so the poem is called, Selkie. Selkie is this the idea of the seal person. The person becomes a person. Seal can change into a person, vice versa. So that's the starting point. Selkie for Slim Jim. Relict of a naughty postcard. Deck chair sprawler on a lock. You're the fat boy, bunter, lard. Last man round the old school track, until we're taken out to swim. To learn to swim, our jumping off the side sets up a maelstrom, spray and churn have barely settled when you dive. Instead of belly flopping foam, we witness mirror finish calm, as if the water were your home, that on this silent entering becomes the pool. And Silouan, brushed by an angel's wing. Now the second poem was a bit lighter, and it basically picks up on the idea of confirmation. Confirmation is the sacrament that makes you strong, but it also makes you very confused, because the catechism always showed the Holy Ghost, as he was then, as a bird. And at the same time, it talked about him as a paraclete. And of course, if you run those two together, you can very easily find yourself thinking about a paraclete, which is also known as the common budgie. And when I was growing up in Korea, everybody had a wee budgie. And they were all the same size, same color, they all had the same name. That's what gives the title of this. This is the Joy Trinity. There were three budgies in one Joy, co-equal but not co-existing. The first taught wisdom through experience, seizing the chance of an open door to ascend into heaven. The second took after Father Peyton, setting up a crusading racket, joyful, sorrowful, glorious by turns, during the family rosary. The third, Mirabile Dictu, learned to say his name, the flesh made word, and had the courage to crash land on Dad's bald head, occasioning some tongues of fire. So the third sort of theme in that book was really, I suppose, about my son. Poems about him going through various stages, particularly when he sort of grew out beyond us and took off on his own around the world. And he kept coming back. In fact, he's still back. Anyway, when he'd be on these trips around the world, he would tell young women that he met, if you're ever in Dublin, come and stay. And as he stayed with us, that led to some very interesting connections. One in particular occurred on Christmas Eve. When the doorbell rang and he opened it up, and it was a very large suitcase on the doorstep. And out from behind it stepped this vision of loveliness, who said, I won't say what I said, something about Happy Christmas or something. Anyway, it turned out that Amber was almost like an angel, you know, coming into this fractious entity that is the Irish Catholic Christmas. And because it was kind of a revelation in the middle of the dinner, the poem is called Amber's Epiphany. Was it Christmas Eve you came, the worst time of the year, and nobody speaking of snow? We were all on our best behavior, trying to live up to your name, Amber, between stop and go. But oh, the icing on the cake, when you removed your shoulder wrap and bright tattoos shone all around. Shepherds and wise men nudged awake, drew nigh to view that starry map, and the cat knelt on the ground. So the conversation with my son continues, but it has taken on some very hard edges. He's kind of sort of a computer guy, so he talks to me in jargon, and I'm more of a kind of a Proverbs guy. So this is Proverbs for the computer age. An apple a day keeps a hacker away. Odd news travels fast. Better to light one intel than to curse her the darkness. When the mat's away, the mouse will play. Necessity is the motherboard of invention. Every blog has its day. Fight virus with virus. All that twitters is not scrolled. Let sleeping laptops lie. And finally, beware of geeks bearing gifs. Yeah.
So we're into the last third, okay? And this is a book called The Eyes of Isaac Newton. It was an attempt to kind of get more and more sciencey, but I won't belabor that for you tonight. It also had some attempts to look again at the North and looking back on the type of upbringing I had in the North. And it wasn't so bad. But it did have its moments when it was clear that I was off my own territory and I was badly in need of a history lesson. And this was one of them. And the poem that I'm going to read is basically become it's a poem I wrote for 1916. And I wrote it from the point of view that there are two visions of two versions of 1916. There's the version, of course, in Dublin, in Republic, and then there's the version in France, or in large parts of the north of Ireland. And so the two then sort of have become mingled in this poem. And the poems, the origin of the poem is that, as I say, I was in the wrong street as a very young child, and a boy called me a name that I didn't know. And the name was Fenian. And he also called me another name that I didn't know either. And but given that that situation, the poem is called Alliteration. What do you think about it? When the boy from the soldiers' cottages allowed that I was a fucking Fenian and clipped my ear, I ran home faster than speeding bullets where narrow-eyed my mother clipped the other ear for using such lavatory language. And that was also the very same year I trod on an upturned 6-inch nail that pierced my soul and my mother's heart, and she set to work with Dettol and plaster, all the while murmuring, "Christ crucified." And something else that formed a veil like a gas cloud rolling over the rampart, the murderous gang, green. As I say, the book is mostly about eyes, so there were eyes in that poem somewhere hidden in it. They're a little bit more obvious in this next one, and this is a poem called Pupil of the Eye. And I don't know, I think I was just sort of wandering around on Wikipedia, and I discovered something about the pupil that I didn't know. And I was talking to a woman friend, a poet, that evening. I said, did you know about this thing? And she said, oh, for heaven's sake, all women know that. No, guys. Well, what is it? This is what's called teasing the audience. Pretty dangerous thing to do. Anyway, maybe I can explain in the poem. Pupil. I know the pupil of the eye dilates according to the loss of ambient glow. The pupil, properly an empty space,
a framing of the window of the soul may also register astonishment. As my own must have done, I realize, reading on Wikipedia, to my shame, something new that every boy should know concerning the humanity of eyes. That sexual arousal does the same. But waking in the night and face to face, stare right into the maw of twin black holes is tantamount to angering the fates, to risk collapse of this dark firmament. So, okay. So, I've just got three listed here, but is that too many?
Yeah, no.
Okay, that's good. Sorry, I meant to keep time, but I didn't. Okay, so I'm going to come back to my father. These are all, in some sense, linked with my father, because my father was a bit of a mystery man, although he lived with us. He really didn't. Sorry, he was there. Well, he wasn't there a lot of the time as well. So, and he's much more interesting from that point of view than if you're writing about somebody that they're not, actually. If you don't know anything about them at all, it becomes a challenge as well as an aid. So the first one I'm going to read, the first of the three I'm going to read is called The Male Mind. And it's kind of a thing that we shared. And the thing that we shared was that he was not a great parent, and neither am I, in a better sense of the word, you know. And our behaviors are probably best summed up in that kind of that standard sort of cry, for God's sake, don't tell your mother, you know, just anything wrong all the time, you know. So, anyway, this is where he almost damaged me. The male line. Once my father tried to rouse the fire, my mother being gone to early mass by pouring paraffin from an old jam jar. So focused on the task, he seemed to miss the presence of his young son in the arch of his bent legs, a child too keenly drawn to adult action, always on the search for something new. Well, he would soon learn that when the hairy vapor caught a spark, all hell broke loose. My God, how I whinged. But when in better light, she would remark that my fair eyebrows looked like they'd been singed. I saved my breath to cool my porridge, and he just winked to seal our first complicity. Fairness to my father, I mean, the absence was a lot to do with his trade. He worked in the bar, and so he would be, by the time he came home, we would all be in bed. Anyway, this is one of the things he bequeathed to me, apart from a kind of a sardonic sort of view of life. He bequeathed a certain amount of, a certain facility with mathematics. He had that as well. And so this is a poem called this is the poem called The Mathematical Barman. The mathematical barman lives in a world of his own. He's calculating the average size of the bubbles in each pint, or the different combinations of coins in the right change for a fiver, or the time it takes a drop from the optic to reach the slatted floor. But the customers all love him, and not just because he never says, you've had one too many. He likes to put it this way. There's three types of barman, them that can count, and them that can't.
So I'm going to finish with a poem from the first book, but it connects with my father. It's a kind of one of the few times of closeness, I think, that I can remember of him. And it was basically, I know when it was, I was aged five, and we shared a bed, because my brother had just been born, so there was always that sort of shifting around in beds, at least there was then, when that happens. So, this is the other thing I should have said, that I should say that apart from the mathematics, he bequeathed a certain physique to me. So the only standards are that if you turn sideways, you couldn't be seen. So we're, the poem is called The Bony, and I'd like to say thank you very, very much for kind attention. The Bony. When I shared a bed in 1952 or 3 with my bony father, I was led to believe that we were alone. Now I can own that when his bony frame closed in upon my back and he whispered something, my name, into my bony neck, behind him lay his bony father, and behind his bony grandfather, his bony great-grandfather, all that long-line boniness lying in state, their collective bony weight pulling him down, but slow, a little heavier each year, until he finally let go. And I fear he's here now, with the same bony crew, light as a feathery tongue. Well, they have a job to do, not a word to my